Welcome back to the Food Pod for Humanity, brought to you by Columbia Climate School's Food for Humanity Initiative. I am Josh Bedluija. This is episode 2, and I'm so happy to have you back to our limited series podcast on food waste. In our first episode, Dr. Jess Fonzo, Professor of Climate and Director of the Food for Humanity Initiative, walked us through the global definitions and implications of food waste on our environment and for climate change. Danny Din, also from the Food for Humanity Initiative, provided some critical information on climate risks and greenhouse gas emissions. This episode, let's bring things closer to home, for those of us that call New York home. How do New Yorkers create and then deal with the issue of food waste? Within the city's ecosystems, who handles and addresses food waste? For that, we'll be talking to Dr. Stephen Cohen, who wears so many hats at Columbia University that I think it's best he introduces himself.
My name is Stephen Cohen. I'm the Senior Vice Dean of the School of Professional Studies. I direct the Masters of Science and Sustainability Management Program, the MPA in Environmental Science and Policy. I direct the Research Program in Sustainability Policy and Management at the Earth Institute, and I'm a professor of practice at SEPA.
He'll get into the unique ways in which New York City, by nature of how we interact with food in the city, can in some ways encourage food waste. But first, I have to make sure you hear this great little anecdote about finding an innovative way to use food that would normally be tossed. Let's head to Stephen Cohen's office on Columbia University's main campus in New York City to hear that one.
When I was in graduate school, it was in Buffalo, and there was a bar around the corner called the Anchor Bar. And the Anchor Bar is actually where the appetizer of chicken wings was invented. And it was invented by the bartender who was trying to sell beer. You know, usually you go to a bar, there's peanuts and salty stuff on the bar with the idea of making you thirsty. He, because the rest of the restaurant sold chicken, he had all these chicken wings they used to throw out. And he said, well, I'm going to fry them up and serve them with hot sauce on the bar. And he developed what's now a cuisine that is served all over America. But until the mid-1970s, it was just thrown out. And so it shows you can take parts of food that are wasted and use it.
Okay, to be fair, my research shows that Southern American cuisine had incorporated fried chicken wings long before the invention of the buffalo chicken wing. But indeed, the most agreed upon story about the buffalo chicken wing has Teresa Bellissimo coming up with the recipe in the mid-1960s at the Anchor Bar as a way to use up the inexpensive chicken byproduct that would normally have been thrown out, at least in that region at the time. By the mid-1970s, it was a veritable hit, and the city of Buffalo inaugurated its first Chicken Wing Day on July 29, 1977. I just think that's such a neat example of how a little creativity and resourcefulness in the face of necessity can lead to a new way of looking at a common food, the chicken, and a way to use up as much of it as possible, even if they weren't necessarily motivated by environmental concerns. Okay, so now that I've shared that interesting story, let's get back to Stephen Cohen and how he defines food waste and the ramifications of it.
There are a bunch of different ways to think about food waste. One of the ways to think about it is the food that's prepared, but that after we eat it, there's some remaining. There's also the food waste which is generated during the preparation of food, where we may not use the entire food that we are preparing. A lot of the issue with food waste is what happens to it once it enters the waste stream. About half of America's garbage goes into landfills. And when garbage goes into a landfill, it has several bad environmental impacts. The first is that over time, the weight of the landfill pushes down, and some of the toxics from within the landfill leach out into the environment and can contaminate groundwater. And food waste, while itself is organic, it will push down into the landfill some pollutants that are toxic. The other part of food waste that's more of a direct environmental impact is that it creates methane, which is a very potent greenhouse gas. While it doesn't last in the atmosphere as long as carbon dioxide, it is much more potent as a greenhouse gas. So it warms the environment faster, it just doesn't last as long.
That echoes what we heard in our first episode from Jess about how food waste can negatively contribute to climate change, and from Danny about the potency of methane gas. So what about here in New York City? What makes us unique when it comes to food interactions, especially food waste? Let's head back to Stephen Cohen's office to learn more.
We are often on the street, we're often in mass transit, and so we sometimes buy food on the run. You see people walking down the street eating. You certainly see people on subways eating, maybe in a park bench. And then what do you do with the food that's left over at the end of your meal? You're not going to carry it around. If you're in a car, you might leave it on the seat, you might bring it home and put it in the refrigerator. But if you're traveling the subway, as soon as you're finished with whatever consumption's involved, you're going to get rid of whatever the waste is. We live a very fast-paced lifestyle in New York City, which is different than in other parts of the world and certainly other parts of the United States.
You've got to admit, for those of us that live in New York, that probably sounds familiar. We are often busy and on the move, and we still have to eat. Our food is much more than nourishment. It is our quality recharging time, socializing time, networking time. We're grabbing lunch on the go. We're getting a coffee with colleagues. We're snacking at an event. We're catching dinner in a show. We're meeting for happy hours and after hours with our friends. And it's usually easier just to toss the rest of whatever you've just eaten than it is to wrap it up and put it in your bag or pocket and hope that it survives the subway, bus, or bike ride back home to finish up later. Urban areas have more options to eat away from home than rural ones. Consider also all the add-on items that shops and restaurants include in their takeaway orders. The condiments, sauces, and side items that typically get thrown out by customers. Think of the leftovers at the end of the day that typically get tossed by closing staff at restaurants, bakeries, grocery stores, and supermarkets. When you're dining out, go for the smallest portion sizes required to feel satiated, whether it's a quick bite on the go or a sit-down restaurant meal. When you're eating away from home, pause and consider how you can avoid tossing food unnecessarily. And always opt for a to-go bag to bring home what you don't finish. Maybe to eat as part of lunch the next day, or to put in the freezer for consumption later on down the line. Embrace leftovers. Remember the costs and precious resources that go into the food we consume. The energy, time, water, agricultural land, human labor, and transportation that went into putting it into your hands. If you, like myself, work in an office that often has catered meetings, you may also encounter lots of leftover pastries and sandwiches. Encourage a culture of sharing those leftovers with the rest of the office and visitors like we do. You may want to keep some resealable containers at your desk so you can bring excess food home to share. But the real point is not to guilt you, but rather to encourage you to recognize that the avoidance and reduction of food waste doesn't just happen at home, and that the ways we interact with food throughout our daily routines can be more wasteful than we realize or intend. Let me call in Danny, my colleague from the Food for Humanity Initiative, to explain further the facts on food waste and cities' greenhouse gas emissions.
Increasingly, the world's populations are moving to and living in cities. It's been estimated that by 2050, more than two-thirds of the people on our planet will be living in cities. That process of urbanization, whether due to land use change or people moving from rural areas to urban areas, is happening everywhere, in every country, and has a tremendous effect on the environment. Consumption in urban areas is a key driver of global greenhouse gas emissions. The C40 initiative is a global network of 96 mayors of the world's biggest cities, including New York City, that have committed to a collaborative approach to confront climate change through a number of advocacy efforts by promising to cut their share of emissions by half by 2030 and to help the world limit global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius and to build healthy, equitable, and resilient communities. As a side note, the most recent report from the United Nations warns that we are on track for 3.1 degrees Celsius warming this century. But that's a deep dive topic of its own for another day. Urban areas are where populations concentrate densely. Urban density typically means more efficient use of space, resources, energy, water, and so on, which can lead to a lower carbon footprint per capita, or the average greenhouse gas emission per person. Imagine a city habitant taking public transit, walking, biking, and living in a high-occupancy multi-unit apartment building compared to someone living in a big house in the suburbs who has to drive a car to get anywhere, for example. But the city's infrastructure, policies, and our unique cultures and norms, as well as our own individual habits, lifestyles, and consumption would ultimately lead to different levels of greenhouse gas emissions. A New Yorker who doesn't drive but yet takes taxi rides everywhere and boards round-trip flights every weekend and orders takeouts for every meal probably has a pretty enormous carbon footprint. Having higher incomes and being in a country with higher development status usually correlate with higher energy consumption, waste output, and overall greenhouse gas emissions. All in all, C40 member cities represent 10% of global greenhouse gas emissions when accounting for consumption-based emissions, which include food, construction, waste, private transport, and so on. Almost 80% of all the food we produce globally is consumed in cities. Amongst the urban consumption-based emissions category, food represents 13% of total emissions produced in the largest cities in 2017. If no action is taken, this figure could rise to 38% by 2050.
Joshabed here again. Thanks, Sani, for that information dive into urbanization and greenhouse gas emissions. As individuals, we can make small changes that decrease our food waste in the city, when we're shopping and cooking at home, or when we're dining out on the go. Let's head back to Stephen Cohen for his final word on highlighting organizations that are doing work to divert food waste before it reaches landfills and even the compost heap.
There are ways of taking food that one person doesn't want and still bring it to other people. So there are a couple of big nonprofits in New York City that redistribute food from restaurants that hasn't been consumed, and this becomes meals for people that don't have food otherwise. And so that, in a sense, is food waste, but it isn't wasted food.
That is a great point to underscore. There are a handful of organizations in the city that specialize in food diversion and rescue. First up, food banks have been doing this work for decades, relying on food that would otherwise be tossed to meet the needs of the food insecure in their communities, providing part of a solution to two components of a broken food system. Perfectly good food that is being tossed while people go hungry, despite there being enough to feed them. Food banks seek out partnerships with farmers, distributors, food processors, supermarkets, restaurants, caterers, and events to collect, process, and redistribute surplus food to those that need it. All this food has to meet quality standards. It is perfectly edible, but just not marketable. Perhaps because it is so-called ugly, or there were mistakes during packaging, or because it's just unsold excess. Food banks offer a desperately needed solution to ongoing needs in both our food systems and for climate change. If you do not have a donation large enough to justify a trip to the food bank, community fridges work on a smaller, less formal level to provide a similar service. Essentially, these are fridges located in public spaces that you can add safe, edible food to be accessed by anyone in need. They are a great solution for small fridge cleanouts. If you're going out of town, take a look at the fresh produce that you can bring to a fridge. Once you finally make peace with the pantry items that you know you'll never consume, despite your hopes to experiment in the kitchen, consider sharing them forward via your local neighborhood community fridge. Visit nycfridge.com to find a map of fridges near you. Other organizations like Too Good To Go, Rethink Food, the Food Recovery Network, and NY Common Pantry are engaged in food rescue and waste diversion efforts, with redirected food offered at discounted prices or for free. Based right here in New York City, City Harvest is the world's first food rescue organization and remains one of New York's largest. I am so happy to announce that I spoke to them for this very podcast series, so please keep tuning in to hear from them about the incredible work they are doing on one of our later episodes. But what about all the inedible parts and bits we cannot salvage? Separating, recycling, and composting food and organic waste are a relatively direct solution to manage the extra food and the natural organic byproducts of our cooking and consuming. Rest assured, we'll be getting deeper into composting in our next episode as a recommended way to deal with food waste. For now, let's hear from Danny on how urban food waste affects climate justice in our cities.
Like everything else we throw out, wasted food becomes garbage. Garbage that has to be properly sorted, collected, and disposed of by the city's sanitation department. Unless food and other organic waste get composted, all garbage goes to landfill or illegal waste dumps. When urban areas with very expensive real estate markets run out of space for trash, we ship it to other places and overseas to make it someone else's problem. New Yorkers and our tax dollars pay a price for that garbage export, but the people and wildlife communities that must live near the landfills and the illegal dumps where the garbage end up, they bear all the cost of the associated health and environmental problems. These downstream consequences are called negative externalities. They are often unaccounted for and thus perpetuate environmental and climate injustice. We also encounter that injustice at home in New York City after decades of redlining and other systemic discriminations that influence development and policy. Communities of lower incomes and people of color tend to be more exposed to more noisy highways, air, water, soil pollutants, and even hazardous waste sites, all while having less access to cooling shades, public green spaces, healthy food environments, walking, biking, and public transit infrastructure. An estimated 49% of New York City populations live in such environmental injustice areas, according to a report and mapping tool released in April by Mayor Eric Adams' Office of Climate and Environmental Justice. We are anticipating more frequent climate and weather extreme events to affect New York City, like heat waves and extreme high temperatures, anomalous rainfall patterns leading to drought and flooding, heavy storms and snow blizzards, as well as storm surge and sea level rise. These events can heavily damage homes, buildings, physical infrastructure like roads and utility networks. They can also disrupt the movement of supplies and services, including food. We just saw how this situation unfolded in the aftermath of hurricanes Helene and Milton. In addition to the many lives lost and hundreds of billions of dollars in physical damages, many communities in North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Florida, Tennessee, and elsewhere were stranded for many days without shelter, power, potable water, food, and accessible roads for emergency rescue and relief to reach them. The most vulnerable groups in our city, such as the elderly, low-income families, delivery workers, houseless individuals, people with pre-existing health conditions, are likely to face the greatest risk of hunger, health impacts, and physical injuries during these events. New York City managers and government officials everywhere have all the more reasons to embed food and food waste into their emergency management and preparation plans.
Understanding how food systems work in cities is critical. And investing in food loss and waste reduction measures in cities can lead not only to saving food, diverting that food to communities in need, and lessening the social and environmental impacts, but it can also lead to fiscal benefits and building resilience in the face of climate change. In the first two episodes, we have explored how individual New Yorkers can do their parts to help avoid and reduce food waste. But we recognize the need for solutions to be implemented at larger scales as well. With the outsized amount of food consumption happening in cities, the policy choices that our city officials make, from making plant-based breakfast and lunch meals available in public schools, to enabling businesses and organizations to sell or donate and redirect excess foods to where they can be accepted and consumed, those choices can contribute to better food security and nutrition among the city's most vulnerable people. Their choices as city officials about how food waste is managed and disposed of can create more sustainable interventions that can add value back to the city and provide green job opportunities. There are lots of ways that cities can educate the public about food to improve climate outcomes, like moving to a more plant-based diet, eating healthier quantities, and yes, avoiding waste. We'll continue to explore these solutions in the upcoming episodes of the Food Pod for Humanity's Food Waste series. This concludes our episode 2. A quick note that if you're in need of some food assistance, regardless of income level, check out a food pantry near you on the nyc.gov site in the Department of Youth and Community Development section. Reach out. Help is there. This has been the Food Pod for Humanity. Special thanks to our guests, Dr. Stephen Cohen, and to Danny Din for jumping in again with some much-needed information. Thanks also to the Barnard IMATS Equipment Room for use of their recording equipment. If you have any questions, feedback, or suggestions for future podcast topics, please email me at foodsystems@climate.columbia.edu and put podcast in the title. Subscribe to the podcast wherever you're listening now to ensure you see the next episode when it drops. Until next time.